Bible. I think either the all of archaeology and the Bible truth or improve it. And early in the course, I would use the story of Jericho in Joshua 6 as a case study. And so I thought that would be a good place to begin this evening. First of all, let me read just the first few sentences of the translation by my favorite writer in Joshua 6, and namely myself. The story of the fall of Jericho, Captain Jericho. Joshua 6. Jericho was shut up tight because of the Bnei Israel. No one was coming out, no one was going in. Yahweh said to Joshua, "Attention, I have given into your hand Jericho, its king in it, and the seasoned warriors." Well, listen to what comes next. "You are to watch, you are to march around the city, all the fighting men going around the city once. Thus you are to do for 6 days. Seven priests are to carry seven ram's horn trumpets ahead of the ark." This is the Ark of the Covenant. "And on the seventh day you are to march around the city 7 times, and the priests are to blow the trumpets. At the blast of the ram's horn, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people are to give a tremendous shout. The city wall will collapse on the spot, and all the people are to go up, every man straight ahead." And as the story continues, that's the way it happened. Joshua took the battle of Jericho, and the walls came tumbling down. The problem for the critic and the archaeologist is that the story of the battle don't fit Joshua. The problem being that there were no city walls in existence at Tel Sultan, if that's the site of ancient Jericho, in the 13th century BC. So we have an interesting archaeological and historical problem. Last week we previewed the topographical. Oh, I meant to include also verse 27, I think it is. Very last statement in that chapter. Next to last statement. Verse 26. "Joshua administered an oath at that time before Yahweh, quote, 'Cursed be the man who proceeds to rebuild this city, Jericho. With his firstborn he shall lay its foundations, with his youngest he shall set up its gates.'" So, first city captured in the book of Joshua is and told with great fanfare, that the story of told with great fanfare is also, at the end of that story, placed under a curse and placed off limits for Israelite occupation. What is going on in this chapter? And what does archaeology? How does archaeology help, if it does, to understand something of the history of the period and therefore the story? Last week, we took a leisurely look at ancient topography. This is and did the short, or maybe just the lights one moment, David, to refresh our memory about the archaeological periods that we'll be dealing with. I've placed the generally accepted terms on the board. MB2B from roughly 1750 to 1550 BC. That's the last phase of the Middle Bronze Age.
ending with the revival of the recovery of native Egyptian dynasties, and in this country, on both sides of the river, one after another, the great city-states, the Middle Bronze Age, revival, destroyed. As pharaohs of the 18th dynasty, the most one of the most famous of them being Thutmose III, whose dates are on the board here, campaigned year after year in this corridor between the desert and the sea, reclaiming for the Egyptian empire one after another of city-states that had been governed by princes subordinate to the Hyksos rulers in Egypt since early 18th century. The late Bronze is subdivided into three periods here on the board. There'll be one from roughly 1550 to about 1400. LB2 is subdivided into 2A and 2B. LB2A is the 14th century. This is the era of the famous Amarna letters, diplomatic correspondence recovered mostly by accident, but subsequently some by excavation at the site of Amarna in Upper Egypt, the capital of the empire in the time of the so-called Perethic king, Amenophis IV, otherwise known as Akhenaten. So the 14th century, the years 1400 and 1300, correspond roughly to the Amarna age. LB2B, the last phase of the Late Bronze Age, from roughly 1300 to 1200, and then Iron One, which is subdivided archaeologically into 1A and 1B. We'll not worry about that tonight. But it runs from roughly 1200 to 1000 BC, by which time we are into the monarchy in ancient Israel. King David came to power in roughly 1000 BC, but it takes a few years, to about 961. So those are the archaeological periods we'll be concerned with this evening. Now, David, I don't think we need the lights anymore. West of the, took a legion look last time. This is the most comfortable lecture I've ever given. Thanks to David's pointer. We emphasized the north-south geographical divisions of the country. In the Middle Bronze Age, the great cities were concentrated in the coastal plain here. And in the central hill country, the problem was doing this pointer left-handed. Then there's the Great Rift Valley, Lake Tiberias, so the Sea of Galilee in the north, the Jordan River, the Dead Sea Rift. In the Jordan River, the great cities were concentrated mostly here on our side of the river, where the valley is wider and more fertile because the other side is in the main shadow. From Beth Shan here, at the entrance of from the plain of Esdraelon, alongside the Mount Carmel Spur, where that plain empties into the Jordan River, from Beth Shan to the end of the Jordan River, emptying into the Dead Sea, only one tell on the other side of the river, and that is one major tell, and that is Jericho, because of the lush oasis watered by Ain Es Sultan, whereas on the other side of the river, in that same, roughly that same stretch of territory, four major tells, as we saw last time, and several smaller ones, from Mazar, Tel Mazar, Tel Der, Sa'diyya, Tel Mazar, Tel Der Ala, and Adamiya. We'll see these again in a moment. Then, on the Transjordan Plateau, I'm going to skip over that since we don't need it tonight. This map showing a distribution of middle bronze and late bronze age settlements is now maybe 15 years out of date. But nonetheless, it gives a pretty good example, a pretty good picture of the distribution of known NB and OB sites to both sides of the river, considerably fewer here on our side than on the other. And these cities are, unfortunately, I do not have a map showing a spread of settlements in the early Bronze Age, but if I did, you would see fewer black dots. They would be farther apart. And if we were to look at plans of the site, we would see cities in the early Bronze Age were much, much larger than they were walled cities, much larger throughout the middle and later centuries of the third millennium than in the middle Bronze Age, throughout the second and late Bronze Age. When the number of cities increases greatly, they are smaller than the EB cities, and they are therefore closer together. Many of these Middle Bronze Age cities were founded in the MB2 period, with which our time together begins tonight. Founded in the MB2 period, and many of them, if not most of them, came to a violent end in the 16th century. That is to say, in the period of following upon the beginning of the 18th dynasty in Egypt, the dynasty of native Egyptian pharaohs who were busily, year after year, campaigning in the corridor here between the desert and the sea, reclaiming these city-states for the Egyptian throne. As I indicated on the board here, one of the most powerful and energetic of these 18th dynasty pharaohs was Thutmosis III, whose inscriptions give us a list of 79 cities and towns with which he has dealt militarily in this very small corridor, not much larger in size than the state of Vermont. Then in LB1, the country is very lightly occupied, or rather these towns are very lightly occupied, or in fact mostly abandoned. The entire area was a long time in recovery from the devastating blow of the Egyptian reaction in the 16th century. By LB2, however, in LB2, by 14th century, most of the same sites are flourishing once again. But they are still smaller now than their MB predecessors had been, most of them. They're smaller, and they are mostly unwalled now, in contrast to their MB predecessors. This, as I said earlier, in the 14th century is the era of the Amarna letters, which display such an interesting network of intercity rivalry and competition, with each of these city-state monarchs writing home to Pharaoh, professing loyalty, each of them also competing very energetically for wider control of the area here in the corridor. The one major exception to this pattern of smaller cities here in the late Bronze Age the one controlling a very small area that surrounded them. The one major exception to this is the city of Shechem, which ought to be about this dot, if I remember rightly. Shechem in the north central hill country, controlling the most important pass between the coastal plain and the Jordan River Valley. In the Amarna letters, Shechem is, I should have indicated that in the Amarna letters, a great many of these city-states are ruled by kings who do not have Semitic names, which is very interesting. One major exception to this pattern is the city of Shechem, in the Amarna letters, is the city of Shechem. Incidentally, the Amarna letters give us the name of 24, 25 cities in the same area where Tutmosis lists give us 79. And when we remember that the Amarna, we have only a fragment, or only a part of the Amarna archives, most of them were excavated by a peasant woman and sold piecemeal to various buyers. Only a few of them were subsequently recovered in excavation. So that if we had the entirety of the archives, I would suspect we would have probably about as many city-state names represented in the Amarna archives as we had earlier on in the inscriptions of Tutmosis III. Major exceptions in the pattern of small city-states, not ranging very widely in their exercise of power beyond the city walls. Major exception to that is the city of Shechem in the north central hill country, which seems to have controlled an area ranging from the near northern outskirts of Jerusalem to the farthest reaches of the north central hill country just before it drops off into the plain of Israel. And in this 14th century, a pattern in the Shechem Valley here of new unwalled villages east and west through the pass which separates Gerizim in the south, and up and down the valley into which it enters. New unwalled villages suddenly springing up here in the period in which the most notorious of the princes from the standpoint of the Home Office, at least it must have been, was this Labayu, the prince of Shechem, who is accused in one of his, was accused more than once in the correspondence of having turned Shechem over to people known in the letter as the Habiru, the Bafiru, about whom we talked last night. I think this means that we ought to spend at least one evening with the archaeology of Shechem and biblical texts pertaining thereto. So that will probably be next week. It is an interesting fact that in the 14th century then we have almost as many city-states in the corridor here as we had in the time of the Moses IV, but they're smaller and they are unwalled. Is that a reflection of the new Egyptian policy after the expulsion of the foreign dynasty and their vassals? Was it a new Egyptian policy to leave these cities mostly unwalled? Shechem was an exception to that. The massive MB defenses continued in use, you know, down into the period. On the east side of the river, as indicated by the black dots here, far fewer Middle Bronze and Late Bronze cities, but and evidences of Middle Bronze and Late Bronze occupation, but much more now than back in the days when Nelson Wick was exploring here in the 30s and 40s on the basis of his explorations. As you probably know, Wick formulated the theory that from about the 19th or 18th century to about the 13th century BC, our side of the river was occupied by a largely nomadic population, there being virtually, in the earliest formulations of Wick's thesis, little or no sedentary occupation on this side of the river. The evidence continues to mount that both in NB and in LB, in NB more to more evidence comes out of the northern half of the country, in LB from the north and continuing on down as far as the north, the ancient Moabite plateau, but not from what is known at present, at least, south of the Wadi Hassa, the territory of the ancient Edomite kingdom. So the famous gap in sedentary occupation, which you read about in many of the handbooks still today, is closing, but it is not closing rapidly, and it is not closing uniformly. There is still, on the other hand, the country has not been as extensively surveyed and excavated on this side of the river as on the other, and so you may be quite sure that not all precincts have yet reported in. When I mentioned the exception of Shechem here in the 14th century, with this multitude, I think that's a fair word. In any case, rather large number, maybe as many as a score of new unwalled villages, enjoying surely the protection of Shechem in the 13th century. That pattern then is observed all over the hill country, and especially also up in Galilee in Iron One. In Iron One, we encounter a rapid increase in the number of new unwalled farming settlements throughout the central hill country and in the higher Galilee hills, where it is possible to live now, or at least desirable to live, and they are not building defenses. That's the situation which develops in Iron One. Iron One on this side of the river is much more amply documented than either the LB or the NB periods preceding it. But with one major exception so far, at least in what I have seen, and that has to do with the absence on this side of the river of what you might, what I would call, for lack of a better word, satellite villages grouped around a major urban center, such as we find frequently on the other side in beginning in late LB and especially common in Iron One. So, to summarize for this point, the LB is much more extensive on our side of the river than Glick thought on the basis of his earlier work. And as he acknowledged in his later work. But there remains a serious demographic question. Where was the person power to be found on this side of the river that would be adequate to challenge a network of, an interlocking network of city-states on the other side of the river. Joshua 11 lists 31 kings in the summarizing chapter. You can imagine a territory not much larger than the state of Vermont, with an occupation that could not have exceeded by much, total population could not have exceeded by much a quarter of a million, with maybe not much more than 20 to 30,000 of those people scattered in the whole country. 31 independent, vine-right monarchies competing for the economic support, the military service, the labor, et cetera, of that meager population. You have some idea of what the situation was. But the result of the excavations and surveys thus far raises a question for the interpreter, a serious demographic question. Where was the person power on this side of the river to be found adequate to challenge that interlocking network of city-states, each nominally subject to Pharaoh, but each exerting as much independence as they possibly could in competition for the resources and the power and the labor force at hand. So this brings me to another question, which I had intended to put on the board here, and that is the question, I'll spell it out so we don't need the lights. Maybe you can see it. I'll put it down here. How large was an olive? That's a Hebrew word, biblical Hebrew word, classical Hebrew word, olive, which is regularly translated. It is the numeral 1,000, but that's clear. In many, 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 many texts, olive or elif, sometimes spelled with an E, is the number 1,000. In the first chapter of the book of Numbers, the people are still at Sinai in the as the main storyline goes, and Moses is conducting the census of the tribes. And here are some of the numbers. The number of the tribe of Reuben was 46,500. That's one of the 12 tribes, 46,500. Remember, we said this population could not have exceeded more than a quarter of a million in all God's building. The number of the tribe of Simeon was 59,300. The number of the tribe of Gad was 45,650. Well, before long, we're going to have a population that would sink the corridor into the sea. About 20 years ago now, almost 20 years ago, George Mendenhall, who was one of the early directors of KCOR, published a very interesting article in which he called attention to another use of this same word, or rather its ancestor, in the Maori correspondence. There's letters from Maori, the city of Maori in upper Iraq, I guess it would be today, huh, David? Maori in Iraq or Syria? It's on this side, right, yeah. In any case, the same word there stands for the clan or village muster unit. And he shows very persuasively to my mind and to many others that in the biblical material there is another usage, this other usage of this word, which was later lost, as often happens in language. And so he suggests we reread here in verse 21. The number of the tribe of Reuben was 46 muster units, totaling 500. 46, in other words, the draft quota, the village draft quota, was what? 46,000, 46 units, 500, just under 10 men per unit. So instead of reading 1,000, you're going to have to substitute a number anywhere between 6 and 12, because the muster unit will vary depending upon the commitment that the village elders made in the tribal palavers consultations in which commitments were made to the militia. So the number of tribes sent in was 59 units, totaling 300. Yeah.
You're not talking military, wouldn't that only just include the men,
not
the women and children?
Yes, that would include, or presumably include, the heads of family.
That would be the original census also, so when they are taking, so it would be 59,000 men, not
the women and children? No, in 59 units, mm-hmm. Your 1,000 doesn't belong there.
No,
all,
I know, but like in the first one, they end up counting men and children.
No, they would have been probably counting only males capable of bearing arms. My point is that these numbers are vastly out of phase with the reality of their time as translated. But when you make that substitution, then the size of armies begins to come into focus, and it begins to correspond to the size of population as realistically estimated by demographers today. The number of tribe of Gad, therefore, was 45,000, but 45 units, village units, totaling 650. These lists and these numbers, also in the law, makes a good case, represent the larger population controlled by Israel under the period of monarchy, and they are anachronistically projected back by a later editor who thinks that they that they represent the actual size of administrative divisions in the pre-monarchical period, but they probably come from a period somewhere early in the monarchy where Israel is a nation state controlling a wide ranging geographical area and much larger population. David, correct me if I'm wrong, but to my knowledge, there has been discovered only one city with a late bronze city wall. Is that Saham? Yeah, and that is on the plateau.
I think so. Safut might have.
Safut might have. Down in the valley, this is our side. Much greener, much more productive, because the other side is in the rain shadow. And in the same, roughly the same stretch of the valley, where on the other side, there is only the oasis of Jericho, and so then, this is taken from, as I understand, from the vicinity of Madaba. We're looking down across the northern Dead Sea. Here's the Jericho Oasis up here. The first major mound south of Beth Shan, which far to the north empties into the Jordan River Valley. On our side of the river, a whole series of mounds. Why did I go back? Did I go back first? I did. I'm sorry. series of major canals. Well, here we are on the other side of the river, flying down the rift. This is the barren backside of the Judean hill country, as it's known in scripture. But this is the Jericho Oasis out here. I'm not sure that I can pick out the tell in this picture. Can you, David?
Right up where the road bends.
There. Yeah. That's the most likely candidate. This picture is taken up the slopes behind the Jericho Oasis, looking out across. In other words, this is the view from the other side, corresponding to the one we just had from our side. Jericho is much, the oasis is much larger today because it was watered with the aid of deep wells put down in modern times. But throughout the period of Old Testament times, there was, so far as we know, only the one water source, Ein Es Sultan, at the very base of the Tell Es Sultan, to provide water via irrigation to support the entire oasis. So the oasis is much larger today than it was in antiquity, with this single water source. I'm sorry, I keep hitting the wrong button. Darawa, Mazar, Sardinia, is that Sardinia?
Back to Darawa.
Did it go back? Well, in any case, now we're down at Damia. you get the picture. Four major tells on this side of the river, in the same corresponding to the situation, in contrast to the situation, the same stretch of the river on the other side where we have only the Jericho Oasis. This is Tell Es Sultan, looking across the oasis to the Jordanian plateau. Somewhere in the trees here is the spring, Ein Es Sultan. This is taken from the Tell. You see the lower eastern slopes of the Tell here. Can we go back again? No, I'm sorry, here we are. Here's Tell Es Sultan to the left. In Roman times, the center has moved a mile and three quarters to the east, to the north, at the site known as Tanul Abu Alayak, where major excavations have disclosed one of the several very, very lavish winter palaces which King Herod the Great built for himself. This is one of the hotels which contains part of that complex. This is its interior. The tiles have been removed, but the pattern of this very lavish courtyard is left, and the tiles have left their imprints in the makeup of the flooring. Here's another stretch of beautifully painted plaster decorating the walls. I've forgotten the name of this technique of setting stones on edge to produce this pattern. It may come to mind. The reason for showing this is to give you some indication of the fact that by Roman times there is a lot more water available in Jericho. And this is the remnant of a large pool, tremendous large pool, which is a part of this complex. On the display case back here, I've opened up several books illustrating the archaeology of Jericho,
And one of them is open to a sketch plan, or rather an architect's drawing, top plan of this palace up here. Where did this water come from? Much more water available down here by New Testament times. It comes from the hills. The area that is in the rain shadow. We're not far east of Jerusalem at this point, looking down into the upper reaches of the Wadi Kilt. And today, water comes down from a couple of springs high up here in the hills through an aqueduct that follows the brink of the Wadi for part of the way and then spills down into the Wadi Kilt to flow down past a Byzantine monastery, the Monastery of St. George, and on down to Jericho. Here's another close-up view of the monastery. In ancient times, or rather in Roman times, a massive dam produced a tremendous large reservoir up here, and an aqueduct dating from Roman times followed the top of the Wadi Kilt down to Jericho. But throughout Old Testament times, the only source of water from the Jericho oasis was the spring Ines Sutton. And so if the city was to be of any significant size, the populace would have to make extensive use of irrigation. Major question then, here is the tell again, viewed from the west, looking east. Tell us of one. Roman Jericho, a mile and 3/4 off here to the north. Where was ancient Gilgal? Another important question in the Jericho problem. Because Gilgal is the name of the site which figures in the preceding chapters. After the crossing of the Jericho, or crossing of the Jordan in chapter 3, they proceed to Gilgal, and Gilgal is the setting then of preparations for the siege of Jericho. Preparations for the siege of Jericho are very interesting. They consist of circumcising everybody to be ready for the conquest, since they hadn't been doing that during the 40 years in the wilderness, according to the main storyline. And 3 days after the circumcision ceremony, celebrating the Passover. In other words, they had only 3 days to recover from ritual surgery before celebrating the Passover, and therefore be ready for the conquest. This reads to me like a touch of the comic, and intentionally so, an ancient touch of the comic, put there by the latest people to work on the book of Joshua, who were updating that book to make it more useful for people living in exile after the destruction of the nation, after the conquest had been undone in the time of Babylonian exile, when the two marks of Jewishness, two prominent marks of Jewishness which could survive in the exile were the practice of circumcision and the celebration of Passover. Finally, so where is Gilgal? All indications are that it has to be somewhere very near Jericho. On your handout, I have included a little map of the wider area of the Jericho Oasis. It's the top of the larger handout here, showing the relative location of major candidates for the location of Jericho, or for the location of Gilgal. On our side of the river, two sites are indicated here, Tel El-Kephrin and Tel El-Haman.
one of which was buried in that, somewhere in that view which we saw a while ago from Madaba, looking out over the northern end of the Dead Sea, because these are the two most likely candidates for the site of ancient Shittim, which is the site of the camp prior to the crossing of the river in the main story line. On the other side of the river, one of the major candidates for the site of Gilgal was the site, they're labeled Nitla, but with no occupation after excavation preceding the Roman period. This leaves the site of Kirbit al-Nefjar at the north edge of what is now the northern limit of the oasis way off here. So we can imagine these friends of mine pondering the question, where is Gilgal? Kirbit al-Nefjar is somewhere out here to at the edge of the trees to the north. It's the location of a splendid Umayyad palace. Here's another view from the mountainside, looking across the western edge of the oasis to the vicinity of Kirbit al-Nefjar out here to the north. Kirbit al-Nefjar is the site of a splendid Umayyad palace, the Hisham Palace, which dates from the 8th century of the Common Era. By that time, of course, Ines Sultan has been supplemented by aqueducts coming down from the hill country, and here is another one still later than the Roman aqueduct which we saw in an earlier slide. And this one, farther to the north, and might well have been providing water for the region of Kirbit al-Nefjar in the period of the Caliph Hisham. The sketch at the bottom of the larger handout, which I gave you, shows a couple of small tells at the north, just beyond the northern limits of that Umayyad palace. And those tells were excavated by James Meilenberg and produced Iron Age pottery. Nobody is quite sure how early the pottery is. And limited excavations produce some evidence of architecture there from the Iron Age. And I have the Meilenberg publication from the Bulletin of the American Schools open to a page which shows the plan of the meager architectural remains which their brief excavations uncovered. So Kirbit al-Nefjar remains then the most likely candidate for the site of Old Testament Gilgal. And if it is the site of Old Testament Gilgal, it was an exceedingly small place, and again, unwalled and defended. Now to the archaeology of the town itself. We'll simply begin with Kathleen Kenyon's work in the 50s, because that's where questions began to get answered. We're looking, this is the northern end of the tell, and Kenyon's work was concentrated in three main trenches, and you have a plan, top plan of the tell on your larger handout here. But your plan is oriented the other direction. Your plan is oriented to the north. Our airplane, alas, is flying south. I should have put the slide in upside down and it would have been MRI. But this is Kenyon's Trench 1 here on the western side of the town. The spring is over here. This is Kenyon's Trench 2 at the north end of the town, and her Trench 3 at the south. This was an excavation which set the standard for attention to detail and accurate reporting for all subsequent excavations in Palestine and on both sides of the river. Absolutely amazing what Kathleen found here. Deep in this trench one, here we are looking at it from the west, is a massive stone tower preserved after excavation to a height of almost 8 meters and something a little more than 7 meters in diameter. Stone tower with a stairway from the top of it going down to provide access to it from the inside of the tower. Here, and here is the corresponding city wall coming off of it. This tower and the corresponding city wall, which went through several phases, Kenyon was able to date to a Neolithic period prior to the introduction of pottery. And this was absolutely mind-boggling. A strongly fortified town of about 40 dunams. That's almost 10 acres in Kenyon's estimate, which would have accommodated a population, she guesses, of approximately maybe 2,000 people in pre-pottery Neolithic period. Carbon 14 dates suggest that this pre-pottery Neolithic goes back, town, fortified town, goes back to the 8th millennium BC. 8th millennium BC. The tradition of the walls of Jericho may have begun very early. This is the base of the tower. And these are some of the earlier circular structures related to it. And here's another view of them. And here's the edge of the tower here. Did I get that slide in right? I don't think I did. Now you're looking down into it. But you're looking out through the trench, and the tower is behind us and out of hidden from view by the bulk here. But the reason for including this is to call attention to these mud brick walls, which date to the period of the early Bronze Age, by which time that tower, wall, which had gone through two phases of pre-pottery Neolithic, had gone through a phase or two of pottery Neolithic before being abandoned for reasons and the tower going into a period of in which it was largely uninhabited for reasons unknown to the excavator, only to revive and to be rebuilt in the early Bronze Age, at which time the Neolithic defenses were deeply buried, so that the early Bronze Age
kind of defensive rise on Rabbi Lublin. This Trench One, incidentally, produced what I suspect to this day, David, is the grand champion of all ball sections. And I have opened the Camden Jericho publication. I've opened her section on the in the publication here on the display case for you to peruse afterwards if you're interested. Here are some more of those early Bronze Age walls. In the Middle Bronze Age, instead of freestanding walls defending the city, as had been the case in the Neolithic period and in the Early Bronze period, Jericho was provided with a massive earthen rampart, which is a defensive structure of earthen ramparts surrounding the city, which is a defensive structure that is characteristic of a great many Middle Bronze II cities. So on the other side of the desert, River Hatzor is one of the most famous examples. Shechem had such a rampart, as did many others, of debris piled up against the slopes of the older mound, then provided with a tamped chalk or plaster glacis, as it is called, held in place at the foot of the mound and out of our picture by a retaining wall at the foot of the slope, and running up against, out of the picture in this slide, a screening wall at the top. And these were the Middle Bronze Age defenses covering, once again, the Early Bronze Age defenses, which are going out of use. And here is a still later wall of some sort sunk into the debris that later accumulated on top of the Middle Bronze Age glacis. Now, the excavations earlier in the century here, especially those by John Karsting, have come upon these walls, which Ms. Kenyon was able to date very definitely to the Early Bronze Age period. Garstein was off by almost a millennium. He considered them LV, and those are the walls which some of the guides to this very day can point to and show you as the walls which fell before the Israelites. But they are Early Bronze Age walls, deeply buried by this Middle Bronze Age glacis, and most of the evidence of the late, almost all of the evidence of any Late Bronze Age occupation here has long since been eroded, washed away into the down to the foot of the tell. A good part of any Middle Bronze Age occupation has similarly been eroded. Kenyon found enough pieces of the screening wall at the top here to confidently describe for us the Middle Bronze Age fortifications. The only evidences of Late Bronze Age occupation, which Kenyon was able to date for us, I do not have a slide, but I have a little popular book on digging up Jericho open to the page back here, which shows a stump of wall, just a couple of horses high, an associated floor running up to it, a taboon, an ancient oven on the floor, and found on the floor and near the wall of the oven, I forgot which, a dipper juglet, which is datable to the 14th century BC. That plus one building which Garstang described and dated himself, or alleged belonged to the Late Bronze Age, but for which no dating evidence was published. And Kenyon allows us how that building, too, may very well be Iron Age rather than the Late feet. So the only late Bronze Age evidence on the tell is this very meager remains of one building, and not datable to the 14th century, a date which is confirmed by the contents of a number of late Bronze Age tombs, which Kevin has excavated in the neighborhood, but which are also characteristically in the middle of the late Bronze Age period, that is to say, 14th century. So, by the end of the 13th century, Jericho had long since been in ruins for most of the century. And the evidences for LB material, which eroded down the slope and were dug up earlier in the wash, or dug up in the, later in the wash, further confirm the gap. Following the Egyptian destruction, a revival and some occupation in the 14th century, but nothing after that until well into the Iron Age. Is that the last slide?
Yes.
So let's have that. So much for archaeology. The first is, of course, in archaeology and the Bible. Kenyon concluded that story in Joshua 6 refers to a 14th century event involving, very likely, in her view, only one segment, one group of the population that later comprised the federation of tribes called Israel. Problem is the period. An alternative interpretation that you will meet very frequently, and one which in many ways is quite plausible, is that Joshua 6 recounts a liturgical event, a cultic event. We didn't talk about it, but the story of the crossing of the Jordan River in Joshua 3 also is highly stylized in such a way as to show the crossing of the Jordan River as something of a liturgical or cultic event. In other words, one approach to these stories has been to observe these marks of liturgical or cultic celebration in both the story of the crossing of the river and the story of the capture of Jericho, and say, aha, our ancient historian here, the sources that our ancient historian was using here, are liturgical. That from a very early period, Gilgal was an important religious sanctuary, which specialized in the celebration of the quote conquest, unquote. And perhaps once a year, that entry into the land was cultically, dramatically reenacted at a site which had already long been in ruins before ever the Israelites arrived. Not implausible. Not at all implausible. A variation on this is that story in Joshua 6 belongs to a genre, a form, which was regularly used in telling stories about the capture of walled cities. We'll encounter a similar problem in chapter 7 and 8 of Joshua, where the city of Ai had been in ruins much longer than the LB Jericho had been. The thing that has always puzzled me, however, a long puzzled me, is why the story concludes with a curse, which places the city of Jericho off limits for human habitation. Why? Why would such a story even get generated? Why go to all the trouble to capture a city that we were not going to be allowed to occupy? Well, it was about 10 years or so ago that I